This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
As an American, I was disgusted. It was unpatriotic. It was un-American. We were watching the Capitol building get defaced over a lie.
Cassidy Hutchinson is no more than 26 years old. She served as the senior aide to former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows in the Trump administration. And on Tuesday, Hutchinson gave the world the most detailed first-hand account yet of what went on inside the Trump White House on the day Congress was attacked on January 6th, 2021.
American flag, face mask, cowboy boots, weapon on the right side hip.
I got three men walking down the street in fatigue while carrying AR-15, copy at 14th for Independent.
Police radio communications there from 8 a.m. on January 6th. In her testimony before the Special Congressional Committee investigating the attacks, Hutchinson said that as early as 10 a.m. that morning, people in Trump's closest circle knew about the heavily armed crowd. Hutchinson testified that she was in a meeting with Meadows and Tony Ornato, Deputy Chief of Staff for White House Operations, when Ornato described the threat. Hutchinson said she was surprised. Meadows was strangely passive. So she turned to him and asked,
Mark, did you hear him? And then Mark chimed in and was like, all right, anything else? Still looking down at his phone.
Not long after, rioters first broke through the meager police line in front of the Capitol.
We just had protests. Peace Circle, breach the line. We need backup.
Ornato called Hutchinson, telling her the Capitol Police were being overrun. According to Hutchinson's testimony, Ornato told her to immediately inform Meadows because they were with Trump at his speech on the Ellipse. She tried to tell Meadows twice.
And when you finally were able to give Mr. Meadows the information about the violence at the Capitol, what was his reaction?
I remember him saying, all right, something to the effect of, how much longer does the president have left in his speech?
Trump was still speaking, telling the crowd that he would go with them to the Capitol.
Mike Pence is going to have to come through for us. And if he doesn't, that will be a sad day for our country. Because you'll never take back our country with weakness. You have to show strength and you have to be strong.
Trump did not end up going to the Capitol. He and the White House staff returned to the West Wing and watched as the rioters swarmed the Capitol building. Hutchinson testified that she wondered when, if at all, Meadows would act to aid Congress.
Around 2 o'clock to 2:05, you know, we were watching the TV and I could see that the rioters were getting closer and closer to the Capitol. Mark still hadn't popped out of his office or said anything about it. So that's when I went into his office. I saw that he was sitting on his couch, on his cell phone, same as the morning where he was just kind of scrolling and typing. I said, you watching the TV, Chief? He was like, yeah. So the rioters are getting really close. Have you talked to the president? He said, no, right now. Still looking at his phone. So I start to get frustrated because I sort of felt like I was watching a bad car accident that was about to happen where you can't stop it, but you want to be able to do something. I remember thinking in that moment, Mark needs to snap out of this, and I don't know how to snap him out of this, but he needs to care.
And then the mob broke into the Capitol, ransacked the building, and disrupted the electoral count certification.
No more than a minute and a half later, I see Pat Cipollone barreling down the hallway towards our office and rushed right in, looked at me, said, is Mark in his office? And I said, yes. He just looked at me and started shaking his head and went over, opened Mark's office door, stood there with the door propped open, and said something to the, Mark's still sitting on his phone. I remember like glancing and he's still sitting on his phone. And I remember Pat saying to him something to the effect of, the rioters have gotten to the Capitol, Mark. We need to go down and see the president now. And Mark looked up at him and said, he doesn't want to do anything, Pat. And Pat said something to the effect of, and very clearly had said this to Mark, something to the effect of, Mark, something needs to be done or people are going to die and the blood's going to be on your effing hands. This is getting out of control.
Just a few moments from Hutchinson's testimony on Tuesday. So what impact has it had? What impact could it have as the Congressional Committee continues unveiling its findings? That's what we'll talk about today. And joining us to do so is Jack Beatty, On Points News Analyst. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Magda.
Also with us today is Chris Whipple, journalist and documentary filmmaker, author of a number of books, including The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. Chris, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be with you.
So, Chris, after Tuesday and hearing what Cassidy Hutchinson had to say about her boss, Mark Meadows, how does Meadows as chief of staff define the Trump presidency?
Well, you know, Magna, I once described Mark Meadows as the worst chief of staff in history in an op-ed piece for The Washington Post back in January of 2021. The truth is, I didn't know the half of it. What we learned from Cassidy Hutchinson's amazing, gripping testimony the other day is that he was not just a world-class sycophant, which, of course, he'd always been, or missing in action when it came to telling the president hard truths that needed to be told. He was all of that, but he was also a co-conspirator in a violent attempt to overthrow American democracy. It's clear from Cassidy Hutchinson's brave testimony that Meadows and Trump knew exactly what they were doing. They sent an armed, violent mob to attack the Capitol, and they didn't care how many lives were lost. Truly staggering. I mean, it sort of almost a definition of the banality of evil.
Mm. You know, so Chris, though, you say it's clear that they sent the mob. I think that is the they sent the mob part is still under dispute. And in fact, I mean, I don't hear Hutchinson's specific testimony as showing that. But the specificity and the repeated moments throughout the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, and 6th of January, I mean, it shows this pattern of, at the very, very, very best, Meadows showing almost complete disinterest in doing anything to stop what they at least knew was coming, right?
Well, I think it was even worse than that. I'd have to argue with you on that, because I think it's perfectly clear that Meadows and Trump knew full well that these protesters, that this mob was heavily armed, and it was nothing but, you know, the results were just absolutely predictable. They fired up this mob and they sent it off to the Capitol. You know, I used to think that the defining image of Mark Meadows in history would be him mugging for Donald Trump Jr.'s video camera in the tent and flashing a thumbs up right before that mob headed to attack the Capitol Police. I now think that his defining image will be sitting on that couch in the White House Chief of Staff's office, scrolling through his phone while that attack took place. It's just remarkable. And you know, I was reminded by Maggie Haberman's column in the New York Times today. The irony here is that Donald Trump described Mark Meadows as his James A. Baker III, if you can believe it. Baker, of course, was the gold standard, the guy who could tell Ronald Reagan what he didn't want to hear. Meadows was the polar opposite of that. He richly deserves that title of worst chief of staff, for which there used to be a lot of competition. Mm. Not anymore.
Mm. Jack Beatty, your first thoughts here on how much detail was revealed about Meadows' behavior? I mean, Chris is exactly right about the scrolling, the repeated imagery of Meadows scrolling on his phone. And then there's also him closing the car door multiple times on Hutchinson as, you know, she was trying to relay critical information about what was taking place in the hours before the mob actually ransacked the Capitol building. Just your thoughts.
And in those occasions, he was on that phone again, wasn't he? And of course, we read that he's suing to block the subpoena the committee has issued for his Verizon phone records. He doesn't want anybody to see who he was talking to, what he was tweeting or typing. So there's undoubtedly something to be learned there. My guess and... from things that Hutchinson said, is that he was in touch with the people at the Willard Hotel, which I think is going to loom larger. It was the, quote, war room, Rudy Giuliani called it, where characters as raffish as Steve Bannon and people who were even more obscure in Trump world were working to do what on that day? We don't know. The cover story is they were calling electors, fake electors in states and things like that. Were they? Or were they in touch with people in the mob? We don't know. But Giuliani's comment to Hutchinson early on where he says, you know, expect something wild, to use that Trump's phrase from the, you know, come and be wild, expect something wild or dangerous on the 6th. That's as close to connection between the point you were making, Meghna, between the charge of seditious conspiracy and the connecting the Trump world with the mob.
Yeah. Well, when we come back from the break, I'm going to want to hear more from both of you specifically about what was revealed regarding Mark Meadows, because hardly anyone was closer to Trump at that time than he was, and hardly anyone was closer to him than Ms. Hutchinson. So Chris Whipple and Jack Beatty, stand by. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're working to understand the implications of Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony on Tuesday in front of the Congressional Investigative Committee that's looking into the attacks on Congress on January 6th. She is the first true first-hand account that we, the public, have heard from what happened inside the Trump White House on the day Congress was attacked. I'm joined today by Chris Whipple. He's author of The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. He's also author of several other books, including The Spy Masters, about CIA directors. Jack Beatty is with us as well. He's On Point's news analyst. Let's listen to a couple of more moments from Hutchinson's testimony about what Mark Meadows knew well before the 6th of January. As early as January 2nd, Cassidy Hutchinson says that members of the White House, or folks close to the president, the then president, told her that January 6th would be no ordinary day.
As Mr. Giuliani and I were walking to his vehicles that evening, he looked at me and said something to the effect of, "Cass, are you excited for the 6th? It's going to be a great day." I remember looking at him and saying, "Rudy, could you explain what's happening on the 6th? He had responded something to the effect of, "We're going to the Capitol. It's going to be great. The president's going to be there. He's going to look powerful. He's going to be with the members. He's going to be with the senators. Talk to the chief about it. Talk to the chief about it. He knows about it."
He's going to be with the members. He's going to be with the senators. Keep that in mind. Hutchinson did take Giuliani's advice, and she says she went straight away to Mark Meadows' office.
He was scrolling through his phone. I remember leaning against the doorway and saying, "I had an interesting conversation with Rudy, Mark. Sounds like we're going to go to the Capitol." He didn't look up from his phone and said something to the effect of, "There's a lot going on, Cass, but I don't know.
things might get real, real bad on January 6th.
Chris Whipple, under normal circumstances, how much power does a chief of staff have? If a chief of staff believes that the president is on the path to making an erroneous decision, in the past, what have those chiefs done?
You know, it's hard to overstate the influence and power of a White House chief of staff when he's he or she, and let's hope there's a she before too long, is exercising that job the way it should be done. It's extraordinarily consequential. I write in The Gatekeepers in my book that if James A. Baker III had stayed on as White House chief of staff for Reagan's late in Reagan's first term and into his second term, there would have been no Iran-Contra scandal. I'm convinced that somebody like Baker would have just put a spike through that. That's how important it can be. They're extraordinarily consequential. And what does it tell you about these people in the Trump White House that Cassidy Hutchinson, a 25-year-old woman, maybe even younger at the time, had to tell Meadows not to go to the war room for the insurrection at the Willard Hotel, or that, oh, by the way, maybe you should say something before the vice president is hung? It's just extraordinary. You couldn't watch her without thinking, you know, what is it about taking the oath to protect the Constitution or knowing right from wrong that's so easy for a young woman in her second job in the White House and so impossible for a grown-up like Meadows? I mean, the truth is that Meadows, far from being a chief of staff, he was, you know, I actually write about him in my upcoming book, which is about the Biden White House, the fight of his life inside Joe Biden's White House, and I cover the transition. And I write that Meadows was really, during this period, he wasn't a chief of staff so much as a glad-handing maitre d', who told everybody what they wanted to hear.
Yeah. So, but let, just to be clear, and you're right to point this out, because you and Jack both are pointing this out, that Meadows, according to Hutchinson's testimony, Meadows had intended to physically go, right, to the Willard Hotel. And that he had to be talked out of it, at least by her.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Right, and but it did, if I remember correctly, she testified that he ended up calling in, so he was at least a participant of some kind in those war room conversations, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, and of course, those details are going to be critical when it comes to any kind of criminal results for Mark Meadows. I mean, obviously, if you tie him to the planners of the insurrection, or the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and seditious conspiracy, the fact that Meadows, Trump evidently told Meadows that he should call not Rudy, but Roger Stone and Mike Flynn. You know, I'm sure we're going to hear a lot more detail about that before we're done.
Right. And of course, we learned on Tuesday that Mike Flynn, when testifying before the Congressional Committee, just took the fifth repeatedly on every question, including whether or not he believes that a peaceful transfer of power he believes in a peaceful transfer of power in the United States. He took the fifth on that as well. Now, going back to what Meadows knew or contributed to regarding what Donald Trump wanted to do on that day. Again, I note that Hutchinson testified that Giuliani said on the 2nd of January that the president was going to be, quote, with the members. He was going to be with the senators, implying that Trump was going to be inside the Capitol building. Well, Hutchinson testified that was pretty well known in the White House, that desire. But several people, including former White House counsel Pat Cipollone, had urged the president not to go.
On January 3rd, Mr. Cipollone had approached me, knowing that Mark had raised the prospect of going up to the Capitol on January 6th. Mr. Cipollone and I had a brief private conversation where he said to me, we need to make sure that this doesn't happen. This would be legally a terrible idea for us. We have serious legal concerns if we go up to the Capitol that day. And he then urged me to continue relaying that to Mr. Meadows, because it's my understanding that Mr. Cipollone thought that Mr. Meadows was indeed pushing this along with the president.
Hutchinson also said that Cipollone told her that if the president indeed did go physically to the Capitol, quote, we're going to get charged with every crime imaginable if we make that movement happen. Now, Jack, I think this is a particularly important moment because we have a senior aide to the chief of staff saying that there, you know, she had been in conversations where the chief of staff had raised the prospect of going to the Capitol, and that indeed it was likely him who was pushing this idea along with the president. Your thoughts about that?
And of course, the chief of staff lied about that in his memoir, right? He said, oh, no, Trump didn't intend to go to the Capitol. And of course, that was one of the first lies that Hutchinson exposed. Cipollone was giving really good advice there, because imagine the scene. Trump goes to the Capitol while the rioters are fighting outside, trying to get into the Capitol, and courageous police and Capitol police are trying to keep them at bay. And he starts maybe with a bullhorn, repeating some of the lines that he had given at the Ellipse about we have to fight, we have to be strong. Well, he would then be almost certainly now under indictment for inciting violence. His speech at the Ellipse, his people claimed, was free speech. It was First Amendment protected by this decision, the Brandenburg decision, which says First Amendment protects people even for inciting violence if there is no likely imminent action. In other words, it wasn't imminent enough from where he was at the Ellipse, but it would have been real imminent right there at the Capitol, and he would have been so exposed. His Brandenburg defense, I'm just using just free speech, all of that, I think, would have gone by the board.
And we learn from Hutchinson's testimony that it's likely because of the Secret Service that Trump did end up not going to the Capitol. But Chris, again, the specificity with which Hutchinson says, you know, talks about Meadows being one of the primary forces of this idea of Trump going to the Capitol. To me, that's obviously far more than just a passive, powerless chief of staff saying, well, the president, you know, wants to do X, so we got to let him do it, right?
No, it's absolutely true. And let's not forget, and this is not an exact quote, but Meadows also said at one point, Cass, it's going to be really, really bad on January 6th. There's no question that it seems to any fair observer of this, it's obvious that Meadows and Trump knew exactly what was going to go down. And just to give you a point of comparison, this may sound kind of ridiculous, but I in the Gatekeepers in my book, I write about how Gerald Ford at one point wanted to go to a birthday party for a Korean deal maker named Tongsun Park. And Donald Rumsfeld, believe it or not, was Jerry Ford's young chief of staff at the time. And he said, now, this is a sleazy guy. You know, he's going to be indicted for influence peddling. You can't go. And Ford came back and said, no, I'm going. God damn it. I'm going. He's my friend. And Rumsfeld turned to him and said, fine. There will be no security for you. There will be no car. You're going to have to walk. We're not going to make this happen. And Jerry Ford backed off. I mean, it's quaint, right? It's just absolutely quaint in comparison to a bloody attempted insurrection. Can you imagine any other chief of staff doing what Meadows did here? It boggles the mind.
And it also makes me wonder a lot more about the calls that Meadows was receiving that day, you know, from members inside the Capitol building begging for help. But here's another moment from Hutchinson's testimony where she says that people, you know, in the White House, again, Pat Cipollone, most notably, were telling Mark Meadows that he needed to do something to break through with President Trump to stop the rioters, especially after they began chanting, "Hang Mike Pence." But Hutchinson says Meadows continued to not act.
I remember Pat saying something to the effect of, Mark, we need to do something more. They're literally calling for the vice president to be effing hung. And Mark had responded something to the effect of, you heard him, Pat. He thinks Mike deserves it. He doesn't think they're doing anything wrong. To which Pat said something, this is effing crazy. We need to be doing something more.
I will note that after Hutchinson's testimony, Pat Cipollone, who had been trying to sue to stop his Verizon phone records from being used by or examined by the congressional committee, he dropped that lawsuit. Cipollone did. Since then, also, the committee has subpoenaed Cipollone to testify. We will see what happens with that. But Chris Whipple, Jack Beatty, stand by for a moment, because I want to bring in Alan Rosenstein. He's an associate professor of law at the University of Minnesota, and he also used to work at the Justice Department in the National Security Division. He was there from 2014 to 2017. Professor Rosenstein, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
So how pivotal was Hutchinson's testimony for you on Tuesday?
For me, it was pretty jaw-dropping. And in my ongoing thinking about whether or not Trump will be and should be, as a legal matter, criminally prosecuted for his actions on January 6th, it was a real turning point. I have generally been skeptical of the criminal case against Donald Trump for his actions on January 6th, though obviously I deplore what he did. But the Tuesday testimony really changed my mind, and I think it is now, both as a predictive matter, more likely than not, and as a legal and even moral matter, appropriate to bring charges against Donald Trump.
And beforehand, your skepticism was grounded by the fact that that President Trump on that day was speaking, right? And that wasn't adequate enough for any sort of direct connection or to bring charges against him.
That's correct. I thought that, or my view is that there was not enough evidence, at least that was public, that Trump either had the requisite intent or that Trump did anything more than deliver an admittedly inflammatory and lie-filled speech. But within our tradition of broad First Amendment protections and a general culture of broad, unfettered political discussion, I didn't think it would be appropriate on those facts to bring a criminal prosecution. But we've learned a lot, not just on Tuesday, but throughout the hearings, about both his state of mind and also additional things that he did beyond just the words that he spoke at the quote-unquote Stop the Steal rally.
So, regarding those additional things, it seems as if one of the most important Hutchinson revealed in her testimony, and that is what Trump said as they were letting people into the cordoned off portion of the ellipse for his speech before the crowd. He wanted more people to be able to come in, but there were many who refused because they had to pass through Secret Service secure, you know, metal detectors or magnetometers, and they did not want to pass through because they were armed and those weapons would be taken away. So here is what Hutchinson said that Trump said about those sort of secured entries.
I was in the vicinity of a conversation where I overheard the president say something to the effect of, you know, I don't effing care that they have weapons. They're not here to hurt me. Take the effing mags away. Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here. Let the people in. Take the effing mags away.
Alan Rosenstein, why is that so important?
Well, I think it's important for two reasons. And I will just say, I have listened to that clip a number of times now, and I still find it gobsmacking that the president would have said that. And I'll also point out that although since Hutchinson's testimony, there has been some dispute about some of the details that she put forward, especially about the car ride, no one, as far as I can tell, has really disputed that point, the remarks that you just played. And I think that's really important because they go primarily to the issue of intent. Donald Trump, I think it's really beyond a reasonable doubt, understood that the crowd was armed, that the crowd was dangerous, that the crowd was potentially up to no good, and quite possibly wanted that, and at the very least just didn't care. And within the law, not caring about bad outcomes that you know are reasonably foreseeable is not a defense. So that, I think, goes to the question of intent. But also, and I think this is really important, it actually also goes to the question of the actual actions that Trump did. I mean, up until Tuesday, the assumption, at least my assumption, was that Trump went and gave a speech. But he did more, as we know, than just give a speech. He gave an order. He tried to get the magnetometers removed, which would make the situation more dangerous.
Alan Rosenstein, stand by for just a moment. Jack Beatty and Chris Whipple as well. There's more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just a quick note about something we'll be talking about next week. And it has to do with air travel. Yeah, you're groaning already because it's already been a tough summer for American travelers. And, you know, maybe for employees of airlines as well. So we want to hear from you. If you're traveling or have traveled on a flight recently, call and tell us about the experience, the good and the bad. Was your flight canceled? What was it like on board? If you work for an airline, would love to hear what you're experiencing right now. This is an industry that got a $50 billion bailout during COVID. Should we expect a little better at least now? Leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. We're going to be talking about the airlines. Today, we are taking a close look and trying to understand the impact of Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony before the committee that's investigating the January 6 attacks on Congress. Hutchinson, of course, was a senior aide to former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. I'm joined today by Alan Rosenstein. He's an associate professor of law at the University of Minnesota, served in the Justice Department in the National Security Division from 2014 to 2017. Chris Whipple is also with us. He's a journalist and documentary filmmaker, author of The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. And Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst, joins us too. And Jack, I was wondering, I'd love to hear your response to Professor Rosenstein's observation that beyond sort of campaign rhetoric, now what we know Trump said on January 6th behind the scenes effectively was issuing an order to decrease security on the day.
Yes, and some people have connected that with the seditious conspiracy that he knew they were armed. He was sending them to the Capitol to invest the Capitol and break up the meeting and the Electoral College determination. There's another way to look at it, which I think doesn't take Trump off the hook at all, but I think is closer to at least my sense of the facts. What we saw there was what the New York law calls depraved indifference to human life. The British called it depraved heart, and Trump has a depraved heart. Yeah. Depraved indifference is defined as a person has depraved indifference to human life when that person has an utter disregard for the value of human life, a willingness to act, not because he or she means to cause grievous harm, that would be the seditious conspiracy idea, but because he or she does not care whether grievous harm will result. That's what we saw there, a man with a depraved heart.
Mm. Chris Whipple, how does that then tie into what we were discussing about what Hutchinson testified regarding Meadows' actions and inactions in the week, even before January 6th?
Well, none of it's good for Meadows, clearly. And just to expand on what Jack and Alan have said, Alan's the lawyer, the law professor. I'm not. But just as a presidential chronicler, it's hard to overstate the stakes here. I mean, for the country and for Biden's presidency. I mean, I think Biden's presidency will be judged to some extent, obviously, on what he does with Ukraine. But I think that what Joe Biden's Department of Justice does or does not do when it comes to prosecuting Trump and his cronies is going to define this presidency and this period of American history. You know, we don't think of ourselves as a banana republic that prosecutes previous regimes, but arguably the only thing worse is to look the other way when you have a president caught red-handed trying to overthrow the democracy with violence. So I think it's a very, very huge deal. And frankly, if I'd been, I'm not a headline writer, but if I were working for the New York Daily News, my headline right after her testimony would have been, "Over to you, Merrick."
Well, I have one last question for you, Chris, and it has to do with where Hutchinson's testimony ended. She was asked by Representative Cheney if Mark Meadows had sought a pardon from Trump. And Hutchinson said with total clarity, yes, he did seek that pardon. Now, we don't know if he got one, but how did that land with you?
Well, again, it didn't land well at all. I mean, it's just one more strike against Meadows, but not the most important one, I don't think. And let me just say about Cassidy Hutchinson and also Liz Cheney. You know, when you watch her testimony, and again, her ability to know right from wrong and was startling. I mean, it makes you think that Liz Cheney was onto something when she said last night at the Reagan Library that, I was fascinated by the fact that she says that young women come up to her, Liz Cheney, and they absolutely understand intuitively what is so wrong about this, unlike so many of the men who were around Donald Trump. And it makes you think she was onto something when she said men are running the world and is not going too well, is it? I think that I can't overstate the importance of her testimony and her bravery.
Chris Whipple is author of The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. He's also written a book called The Spy Masters about the CIA, and he's got that upcoming book about the transition to the Biden administration. Chris, thank you so much for coming back to the show.
My pleasure.
So, Professor Rosenstein, you heard Chris Whipple's headline that he wished to have seen, the "Over to you, Merrick" headline. What do you think?
I think that's right. When prosecutors decide whether to bring a prosecution, and this is true for the lowest level prosecution up to when the attorney general has to make a decision of just almost incalculable magnitude, it's not just about whether or not the prosecution would be legally and factually supportable, though obviously that's a requirement. It's also whether the prosecution would be in the public interest. And that itself is not fundamentally a legal question. That's a policy judgment. And I do think that Donald Trump has left the country and most immediately Merrick Garland with nothing but bad options. I do think that prosecuting not just a former president, but someone who is still an active political figure, who is still, I think, the presumptive frontrunner for the Republican nomination in 2024. That's, as our current president would say, a big effing deal. That's not a good thing. And it's something that contributes to democratic instability, and it's something that if it happened in another country, we would, I think, criticize. At the same time, if the alternative is to tacitly admit that a president is just above the law in not just illegality, but in the fundamental attack on American democracy, I think that's worse. You know, we've had presidents who have done bad things. We've had presidents who've committed crimes. You know, obviously, Richard Nixon and Watergate is maybe the most famous example. And I have to say, Trump makes Richard Nixon look like a Boy Scout. And I just don't see how if the Justice Department convinces itself that the legal and factual case is there, how it could conclude that letting Trump just go get off scot-free is in fundamentally the interests of the American people. Though I will say this is a difficult decision, and I in no way envy Merrick Garland in having to make it.
So, but let me ask you just briefly and clearly, with those complications in mind, though, do you think that there is enough evidence now for the Justice Department to indict Donald Trump?
If I had to give an answer, I would say yes, but I do want to emphasize that we are in uncharted territory, and the error bars around any prediction or judgment, I think we have to be humble and recognize that they are broad. But I have gone from, more skeptical to less skeptical than not.
And if an indictment were to come down, I'm still just very taken by what you said earlier in the show about evidence, at least testimony now, of actual actions that Trump took on the day. Is that key here?
I do think it's important. Again, when we're dealing with the president potentially inciting a riot to attack the Capitol, we are dealing fundamentally uncharted waters. Mm. And there's just no way we can read the statutes or the case law and really know how they apply. That's just not how the law works. So we have to make some judgments. I think that by itself, the president's statements were kind of borderline, just the statements themselves that he made in the speech. But I do think if there really is evidence, and again, you'd have to be established in a court of law, and that's its own thing, there really is evidence that the president gave an order to decrease the safety, knowing that those people were then going to go to the White House. Then they were going to march to the Capitol. That strikes me as a separate and quite damning action to encourage a riot or obstruction of Congress or potentially even seditious conspiracy.
Yes. Do you see, is there adequate evidence now for the Justice Department to indict Mark Meadows?
That I'm much less clear about. As your other guests have mentioned, the chief of staff's role is obviously very powerful, but it's also often exercised through informal influence. And being bad at your job, being the worst chief of staff in history, which I think there's a very good argument for Meadows in that regard, is disgraceful, but it by itself is not a crime. Now, other evidence may come out. The committee has teased that they will be presenting evidence of actual contact potentially between the White House and some of the groups there. And obviously, if there's evidence that Mark Meadows was actively plotting to get dangerous people to go march on the Capitol, that's a big problem for him. Mm. I don't think that just staring at your phone and disgracing yourself is a crime.
Right. But now, of course, he's fighting to keep the congressional committee from knowing what's on that phone. Jack, I'm going to come to you in a second here, but I just want to play one more moment from Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony on Tuesday, because according to her, legal counsel around Donald Trump were definitely concerned about the legal implications of things Trump wanted to say and do on January 6th. So here's Hutchinson describing what legal advisor Eric Hirschman, along with other White House counsel members, told Trump about language he wanted to use during that speech at the rally on the Ellipse. And so here's what she said.
In my conversations with Mr. Hirschman, he had relayed that we would be foolish to include language that had been included at the president's request, which had lines to the effect of, fight for Trump, we're going to march to the Capitol, I'll be there with you, fight for me, fight for what we're doing, fight for the movement, things about the vice president at the time too. Both Mr. Hirschman and White House counsel's office were urging the speechwriters to not include that language for legal concerns and also for the optics of what it could portray the president wanting to do that day.
Of course, Trump ended up saying something basically to that effect on the day. Jack Beatty, your thoughts about Professor Rosenstein's analysis of the next moves from the DOJ?
Well, it's going to be a momentous decision, and almost certainly one in which violence will have to play some calculation. Trump has warned recently that if he's indicted, as he put it, by racist prosecutors, meaning the woman in Fulton County, Georgia, and the black woman, and the black woman in the Letitia James in New York, if he's indicted for anything, he's going to call his people out. I assume that would go for the Justice Department in spades. So in other words, he's even going to use, I think, the threat of violence as a way to deter prosecution. I expect we're going to hear more from him on that. But it's also a real question. Is it worth going after him if the result is going to be political violence in a nation with 400 million guns? Or should you just essentially accept what Bob Woodward seems to think is the truth? He says Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony wrote Trump's political obituary. Is he already a spent volcano? Does he, could he possibly now win a Republican primary with, you know, even outfits like the Washington Examiner saying he's unfit to be anywhere near power again? The National Review devastating her testimony. Is Trump a spent volcano? And therefore, is it worth the risk of the violence to go after him to vindicate the principle that no one is above the law?
You know, I believe Bob Woodward, with the, you know, mountains of respect due to him, is got his hands covering over his eyes from the past, you know, 6 years of history. Lots of Beltway folks have, quote unquote, written Trump's obituary multiple times, and his political career did not die. So, Professor Rosenstein, we've just got a minute left to go, and I have one last question for you. Both being a scholar of the law and having worked inside the Justice Department, I completely hear you about, you know, both you and Jack are thinking about the destabilizing effect, the democratically destabilizing effect of bringing charges and prosecuting a former president and potential presidential candidate. But at the same time, the democracy has already been destabilized, right? It was destabilized on January 6th and arguably even before that. At what point in time must our institutions stand up and say, no, we cannot be held hostage by the threat of political violence, and that in order to preserve the meaning, dignity, and future of those institutions, we have to take the risk?
I think this is the time. I think the problem, and this is a fundamental problem for all policymakers, and I'm very glad that I'm not the Attorney General, is that we can't know. We just can't know what the second, third, fourth order effects of a decision to prosecute or a decision to not prosecute Donald Trump will be. We really are in fundamentally uncharted territory. And in that case, I think at some point you have to give up trying to prognosticate and instead go back to your fundamental principles. And I think the fundamental principles have to be that we are a nation of laws and no one, not even the president, is above them.
Well, Alan Rosenstein, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota, formerly at the DOJ's National Security Division, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Jack Beattie, On Point News Analyst. Thank you, Jack, always, as well.
Thank you, Magna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.